Thanks very much, Manuel. Thank you to the Japanese Consulate General and to the other sponsors for the invitation to speak to you today. I'll be basing my remarks today on the RBA's latest quarterly economic statement, which was released last week. It's too early for there to have been any material change of view since then, and so I stress that I'm not in any way offering a different assessment to the one that I gave then. When I spoke at this event in March last year, the situation was very different from the one facing us today. Let me start by recapping some of the key features of the economic situation back then, as I summarised it at the time. Global growth then was above average and was expected to remain so. Growth in the year just completed, 2006, was estimated to have been more than 5%, making it the strongest year for the world economy in more than three decades. Forecasts by the IMF and other observers were that world growth would remain high in the 2 years ahead. That view turned out to be correct as far as 2007 was concerned, although, as I'll come back to later, conditions have turned down sharply in the current year. The main weak spot at that stage in the first half of last year was the downturn in the US housing sector, which was already well underway. But the US economy overall was still growing at 3% at an annual rate, and other parts of the world, notably Japan, the euro area, China, and the broader Asian region, were all picking up speed. I noted too at that time that in Japan there were signs that the long period of balance sheet repair was showing some positive results. Bank lending was expanding again and conditions in property markets were improving. Another important feature of the global economic situation at that time was the strength of commodity prices. Measured in foreign currency terms, the index of Australia's commodity export prices was about 80% higher than 2003 levels. Australia's terms of trade had risen by about 10% per annum over the preceding 3 years, and that was delivering a major boost to the growth of national income. That was partly a cyclical phenomenon resulting from a period of above-average growth in world demand and output, but it was widely recognised that there was also a structural dimension to it, with Chinese and Indian industrialisation providing a major addition to world commodities demand. And of course, at that stage, the big increases in coal and iron ore prices from the next round of contract negotiations were still ahead of us. So, in short, the international situation at the time of last year's conference was one that was highly favourable to growth in incomes, in spending and output in Australia. The subprime debt problem in the United States was just beginning to attract attention, but the full ramifications of that were not yet apparent. Against that background, growth in the Australian economy last year was strong. Unemployment fell to 30-year lows, and domestic demand over 2007 was growing at an annual rate of more than 5%, well in excess of the growth in the economy's productive capacity. This was an environment where spare capacity was becoming very limited. One summary indicator that I commented on last year was the capacity utilisation measure from the NAB Business Survey, and by that stage it had already reached its highest levels since the survey began, and it went on to rise further before it started to turn down during 2008. In this environment, it's not surprising that there was upward pressure on Australia's inflation rate. When I spoke last year, underlying inflation was running at an annual rate of 3%. The latest quarterly figure at that point had softened a bit, but the annual rate was still higher than ideal, and the combination of strong demand and scarce productive capacity pointed to further inflation pressure in the period lying ahead. In the event, inflation in Australia did rise significantly further. On the latest figures that we have for the September quarter 2008, underlying inflation has now picked up to a rate of just over 4.5%, with the headline figure at 5%. As in a lot of other countries, a significant part of the increase in inflation during this period was accounted for by food and energy prices. But it's worth making the point that the rise in inflation was quite broadly based. One way of illustrating that is to look at the proportion of items in the CPI rising at annual rates in excess of 2.5%. Given a roughly symmetric distribution of price movements, attainment of the inflation target requires that about half the items on average should be running at a rate above the target midpoint at any given point in time, and half running below that. But in the latest year, roughly three quarters of the items in the CPI have been above that benchmark. In fact, while global commodity prices have been an important contributing factor to inflation, the rise in Australia's inflation rate over the past 2 years was to a significant extent domestically driven. We can illustrate that by dividing the CPI into those components that have a significant internationally traded exposure and the remaining predominantly non-traded items. Most of the rise in core inflation came from the non-tradables component, which picked up from around 3.5% to around 6% over the last 2 years. In contrast, the tradables component, excluding volatile food and energy items, was relatively stable. It's clear then that coming into this year, the economic situation in Australia was one in which capacity utilisation was high, demand was growing strongly, and inflation was rising. It was against that background that the RBA was seeking to restrain demand in order to exert downward pressure on inflation over time. Turning now to the current outlook, it's important to recognise that the extraordinary financial events of the past 2 months have had a major bearing on economic prospects, both internationally and in Australia. With that in mind, I want to focus the remainder of my remarks on two themes. Firstly, how conditions in Australia were developing in the period leading up to those events, and then how this new phase of the financial turmoil might affect the global and Australian economies from here on. The latest national accounts that we have are somewhat dated now, but they provide a useful summary of how things were evolving in the period up to the middle of this year. They show that output growth slowed in the June quarter, but it was still running at an annual rate of 2.7%. Domestic demand was growing at a higher than trend pace, but it was also slowing. As a general observation, the accounts suggest that conditions up to around mid-year at least were evolving more or less as expected, which is to say that reasonable growth was continuing, but the required moderation in domestic demand was occurring. The slowing in demand to date has been largely driven by household spending. Consumption fell slightly in the June quarter, and the indications from retail sales data are that it stayed quite subdued in the September quarter. Households now seem to have entered a period of consolidation in which their spending and their indebtedness are growing more slowly than incomes. That adjustment, provided it remains orderly, should be helpful in laying the basis for sustainable growth in the longer term. In contrast to the household sector, businesses were still increasing their spending quite strongly in the period up to mid-year. A lot of that investment growth was mining related, but even in the non-mining sector, business investment up till now has been running at a high level. Nonetheless, the indications from business surveys are that conditions have softened, and a number of surveys are pointing to investment plans being scaled back in the period ahead. One of the factors contributing to that has been tighter financial conditions, with a number of businesses reporting greater difficulty in obtaining credit, particularly in the construction sector. Labour market indicators also confirm that a significant moderation of growth of economic activity has been occurring. Employment growth has eased back from a 3% annual pace in the early part of this year to something closer to 1% in the past few months. Unemployment is still close to 30-year lows, but job vacancies have been falling, indicating some easing in the earlier scarcity of labour. Taken together then, we have a general picture based on recent data of subtrend growth in the Australian economy. But the domestic indicators that are available to date still largely cover only the period up to the September quarter, and so they are of limited value in assessing the impact of the latest round of financial turmoil, which dates from mid-September. The trigger for this latest turmoil was the collapse of US investment bank Lehman Brothers on 15 September, which itself followed the effective nationalisation of the US national mortgage agencies during the previous week. These events were followed in quick succession by the nationalisation of the US insurer AIG, along with a string of other announcements of the failure or near failure of financial institutions in the United States and Europe. All of this has been accompanied by some exceptional volatility in world financial markets. During September and October, US equity markets recorded some of their largest daily movements in both directions in history. In net terms, US equity prices have fallen by about 30% since the Lehman collapse, and the Australian market is down by about 25% over the same period. Policymakers around the world have responded to these developments in a number of ways. Central banks have been adding liquidity to their financial systems, and they've been cutting official interest rates. Some governments, including in Australia, have announced substantial fiscal stimulus packages. And governments around the world have taken direct measures to strengthen their financial systems, including capital injections, enhanced protection for retail deposits, and the offer of guarantees to various types of wholesale lending. These steps should help to stabilise conditions over time, but sentiment is still fragile. In addition to the volatility in financial markets, commodity prices have fallen sharply during this period. Some of that was already happening, but the renewed episode of financial turmoil has accentuated the trend. Oil prices are now trading below $60 a barrel, having peaked in July at $146. Base metals prices have fallen by around 35% since early September. And spot prices for steaming coal and iron ore are now trading below current contracts after having been at premiums of 40% or more around mid-year. These are big movements, although it has to be acknowledged that the prices of some key resource commodities are still high in absolute terms. Obviously, these market developments present significant uncertainties for the world economy as a whole. Conditions in some of the major economies were already softening when the latest turmoil broke out, and these recent events have prompted sharp downward revisions to official forecasts in the last few months. As recently as August, IMF forecasts for world growth in 2009 were for growth of 3.75%, or close to the long-term average. In response to the recent financial turmoil and other new information, that forecast was revised down to 3% in October and again to 2.2% by early November. That figure incorporates a fall in GDP in the G7 economies and sharply reduced growth in the developing world. On the positive side, lower prices of oil and other commodities should assist consumers around the world and will also help to reduce global inflation. In assessing the impact of all this on the Australian economy, it's important to take into account some significant factors working in the other direction. The official cash rate has been reduced by a total of 200 basis points since September. The fiscal package announced by the government in October will provide a near-term stimulus of a bit under 1% of GDP. An additional factor is the depreciation of the Australian dollar exchange rate, which in trade-weighted terms is down by about 25% over the past 3 months. All of these factors will help to cushion the effects of the much more difficult global environment in which we now find ourselves. Even so, the forecasts that we released last week and which are summarised in this table envisage a significant further slowing in the Australian economy from the pace recorded at mid-year. Growth of non-farm GDP is now expected to reach a trough of 1% in year-ended terms by the middle of next year and to remain below trend for some time beyond that. Inflation is likely to fall. But I have to emphasise that any forecasts in this environment are subject to a great deal of uncertainty, not least because the situation in world financial markets is still changing rapidly. Thanks very much, Manuel. I'll leave it there.
Once again, this is a rare opportunity to ask a few questions, and the same rules apply as before, so anybody who has a question from this side? Or
thanks. Well, as you will have seen from the table I just presented, we expect inflation to gradually return to around a 2.5% pace over the forecast period. There are factors working in both directions for that forecast. We have to remember, when we're comparing ourselves with the rest of the world, that we've come into this episode with stronger inflation pressures than other advanced economies. If you do the comparisons of core inflation rates, Australia's core inflation has been stronger than it's been in the other countries that we would normally compare ourselves to, and that's really a consequence of the Australian economy having been stronger over the past few years. So we're starting from that position with a higher starting point. Obviously, both global and Australian conditions are now softening. The outlook for growth in demand and output has weakened all around the world. That's an environment where inflation can be expected to fall. One factor working against that is the depreciation of the Australian dollar exchange rate. And in the way that we've adjusted our forecasts to allow for that, we believe that in the short term, it actually takes a bit longer for underlying inflation to come down. But once exchange rate effects start to drop out of the calculation, the effects that predominate are the slower growth. And so we believe that towards the end of the forecast period, that'll be putting significant downward pressure on inflation. One further point to note is that we'll be getting quite a bit of help in the short term from falling oil prices. And so one of the factors that makes us feel a bit more confident that inflation's coming down is that the headline CPI should be dropping quite smartly below the underlying series in the near future, and that should help to bring down inflation expectations. I have to say I'm not really a spokesman on the response of the banking system, other than to make the general point that we have cut rates substantially over the last 3 months, and most of that has been passed on to end borrowers, and we do think that that will have a significant supportive effect for the economy. Thank you for those questions. I must say I'm grateful to Mr. Shinohara for pointing out how difficult it is to be frank when we have media in the room, so it saves me from having to point that out myself. The answer to the first question is yes, we did take that into account. Those numbers were just being released at the time that we finalised our report, so we knew about that. And in fact, the numbers for the world economy that we've based our forecasts on, even with the IMF downward revisions, our numbers are still lower than the IMF numbers. So that's been a consistent pattern right through this year, that we have felt that the outlook for the world economy was weaker than some other official forecasters were factoring in, and so we've built that into our outlook. On the forecasts, all I can say is that we are forecasting growth to trough at 1%. So I just reaffirm that that is the number that we're working with. Well, it's true that on some indicators, and retail sales is one of them, New South Wales is looking quite a bit weaker than the rest of the country, but it's nonetheless true that a slowdown is occurring quite broadly based across the economy. And my answer to how we deal with that is the same one. People from the Reserve Bank are often asked this question, and it's always going to be true that there's some regional variation in economic performance. There was a long period of time back in the 90s when New South Wales was overperforming the rest of the country, and people wanted to know how we would respond to that. The fact is that we only have one monetary policy for the country as a whole, and so we have to run policy with a view to achieving the objectives that have been set for us for the country as a whole. I think the notion that we have access to a lot of secret information about the economy that can't be known by private sector economists is greatly exaggerated. It's true that we have an extensive business liaison program, and so we do pick up things by going out and talking to businesses every month. As I've said before, we talk to about 100 businesses a month, and that's a very important part of our economic intelligence gathering. But having said that, I really think that the idea that market economists don't have access to the information they need is greatly exaggerated. We're all looking at the same published data. The fact is that the current period is a period of very high uncertainty. Things have been changing very quickly. That's one of the main themes that I tried to bring out in my talk today, is just how quickly things have been changing, particularly in the last 2 or 3 months. And in an environment like that, I think it's inevitable that not everybody is going to come to the same conclusions when they look at the data. Things are changing quickly. People will form different views. That's just the way things are. But our job is to make the best decisions that we can, given the imperfect information that's available to us.